wings up, you see. And he had that cap that I showed you.
The wedge cap.
That's the identical cap that I wore.
The wedge cap, yeah. Then you had your RFC.
RFC badge on it. And you could wear the khaki trousers, or you could wear John Tours and the bandage leggings, or the leather part here, or the long leather boots. Anywhere.
You're allowed to wear the artillery boot. Yeah.
Yes. Anything. Any of those three you could wear. You see.
Well, and you're in Canada. You're coming back into Canada, and we just have an election in 1917, December 17. And there's a lot of talk about conscription and things.
Oh yes, that's right. Quebec. There was a bit of a fuss in Quebec, I think.
What struck you at this time?
I wasn't particularly interested. We figured Quebec didn't want to have much to do with it, and that was that. We thought there might be some trouble as the train went through Quebec, but we didn't experience any trouble. We went through mostly at night. And I remember arriving in Halifax about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, just getting dark. And my recollection is looking out of the window and seeing these three cement steps.
And no house.
And no house. One all the way down the street. Three cement steps and no house.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. And then you got into town and everything was full. Where they'd been last, it was now all boards. And we very shortly got it. They formed the convoy, either in Halifax or just off Halifax. Don't remember.
You don't remember the name of the ship that you were on, do you?
Can't be with that.
That's okay.
It was an old CPR boat that had been a passenger boat at one time, but was turned into a freighter. But for the purposes of the war, and this skipper, our boat, had made 26 trips across, 27 trips across the Atlantic. Up on the upper deck, the first deck anyway, there were between 200 and 300 flying officers. Down in the holds, there were 2,000 Chinese laborers.
Well, where were they going?
They were going to France to do the manual digging of trenches and helping out building this and doing that. Just for labor troops for the front.
Is that right?
Chinese, yeah.
Chinese.
2,000 Chinese.
Okay. Do you have any contact with them on the vessel at all?
No, none at all. None at all. But we zigzagged across the Atlantic.
A lot of apprehension over you both?
Oh yes, all the time. All the time.
Did you
First
have any...
it was a cruiser. Somewhere I found the name of that cruiser, but I forgot it now. There was a cruiser, and then there was a tremendously big Cunarder right behind it. Then there was another huge Cunarder, the Devonia, I think it was. Devonia, yeah. On which there were 14,000 American troops heading for Britain. On the left side, we were the lead, one boat. And there was one boat behind us. Then the third line had three boats, and I don't remember whether they were freighters or troops. There was another boat behind the Devonia. There was the cruiser, one, two, three, four. Then the far outside one, there were four boats, all lumber boats. And everything went fine until dusk off the northwest coast of Ireland. Just at dusk, you wouldn't know whether it was daylight or dark. And they had, because of the worry about submarines, they had us strung all the way around the promenade deck, all the way around it. So
keep
your eyes open for anything. And I was near the stern. And I saw this torpedo go past our stern. Sub, and it hit the Devonia in the center of our convoy. Terrific explosion. And that caused a bit of confusion. Of course, we were traveling without lights, and pretty soon it was dark, and you couldn't see anything, you see. But all you could see then was the flares going up from the Devonia.
Was she going down?
She was sinking, but very, very slowly.
Did she make it into port at all? Or?
I don't think so, but they got all the troops off, except the few that were killed.
Initially, yeah.
In the explosion. Because immediately, It was only a matter of after the torpedo hit, I don't suppose it was more than a half an hour, 20 minutes to half an hour, before there was a fleet of little torpedo boats arrived off the coast. Orders came then.
What, when the torpedo boats came, what orders came?
Came from the cruiser. Everybody for themselves.
That was the order.
That's right. Everybody for themselves, yeah. And this skipper, he was tickled to that order, because he'd been through it 27 times, crossing it, and he knew what to do and how to do it.
Right?
But one of the recollections that I have of that, it was an old boat, that's right, but there's just forward of the dining room, there was a well, and you could look right down on the engine.
Mm-hmm.
It was a triple expansion engine, you know, a small cylinder, then a big cylinder, then a mm-hmm. huge big cylinder. And the thing that I remember, looking down there, and the head of steam they had on, those cylinders were just rocking like this. He had every ounce of steam out there he could possibly get.
He was not going to waste any time, whatever.
Yeah, no, sir, he got out of there fast. But and they kept us on deck just to listen and so on, to get any contact with anything coming or going.
But I guess you must have felt pretty helpless, sir, right?
Yes. This is what happened about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I was still on deck, and evidently there was a huge liner coming this way, and we were going this way, you see.
Well, we're going to
leave and just steered off. It was close enough together that the two captains swore at each other in the darkness. There wasn't a light anywhere, you see, but they're just that close. But plug along. And you know, the whole convoy, we were the first to arrive at the boom at the entrance to the Mersey in Liverpool Harbor. And we had to wait there till dawn. We had to wait there for an hour or two till they unhooked the boom
mm-hmm.
and let us in into the harbor. So up to the dock and unloaded, load us onto trains down to London to the Air Force headquarters.
And what date would this be? I know I keep pressing you for dates, but they're crucial. We're 1918.
It would be, I would say, around the 5th of January.
That early in 1918?
Yes, I think so, yeah. I can find that date out definitely, but I think that's about what it was, 5th of January, yeah. Down to London.
How did you feel there? You got overseas, you're a second lieutenant in the Royal Flying Corps, the war's been going a number of years.
Oh, yes. Well, of course, we didn't know what they were going ahead in store for us or where we were going or anything, you see. But they were having much the same problems in England that we had in Ontario and in Texas. This huge surge of Americans and Canadians landing on their doorstep all at once and not ready for us.
And no facilities at all.
Yeah, not the facilities that they'd like to have. So eventually we put on a train and we went right back almost to Liverpool. To a place called Houghton Park on the south side. The Manchester Canal comes into the Mersey River, and the aerodrome was right at the mouth of the Manchester Canal.
Right at it.
Yeah, at a place called Houghton Park. It was a castle.
Is that the name of the aerodrome itself?
Houghton Park was the name of the area.
Area.
So we had the number 4 training depot station.
Well, Houghton Park sounds much nicer.
Yeah. And the next town over was Sunlight City, you know, Beaver Brothers. And there was just one town after another, all the way from Houghton Park into Birkenhead, I think was the last one. Brighton, I think. And there on the south side of the Mersey Harbor. And that's a big peninsula, you see. And it goes down like that and comes in. And the River Dee comes in here, mm-hmm. the sands of Dee. This is the Liverpool Harbor. And we used to take off and fly around that, you see. In the morning before breakfast, that would be our tour.
This is in Cheshire?
Yeah.
You get there, they don't have proper facilities
well,
for you.
They had pretty well complete hangars. And of course, we all put up in this castle. You were sleeping on iron beds, you see, and these huge rooms in the castle and so on.
So you slept in the castle?
And downstairs we had our mess, you see, our eating place and so on. Oh yes, it was good accommodation. It wasn't too much heat, but if it wasn't warm enough, you'd put on your flying.
Beats the pup tent down in Fort Worth.
Oh yes, so. Yes, yes. So I had about a week's instruction there.
Well, what's the instruction like there, and who the officers are? Is it all Royal Flying Corps officers?
All Royal Flying Corps, and they're usually Flying Corps men who had been at the front in France and had lasted long enough that they were sent home on leave, you see, and they'd done their tour.
They had finished the tour, yeah.
So they used them as instructors. I had two or three different instructors there.
What kind of plane?
Hmm?
What type of plane?
It was an Avro. We were using
the
Avro.
Back the Avro, eh?
Avro. And there were Avros. There were one, two, there were about five different classification of Avros.
Mm-hmm.
The oldest one is the monosopop. It was a little nine-cylinder rotary engine. And then you went from that to the regular. Now, I forget what the name of it was. Then there was the Clergy 110. Then there was the Clergy 130. There was also the Lerone. They had one, two, three, four, five different machines. But pretty soon, with training, the old monosopop got washed out. There was enough crashes that they...
Were these dual controlled, or...?
Yes, they're all dual.
All
dual.
Now, were they called Comics? I know the Camel was called the Comic Camel. Now, was that...
No, this was a bigger plane, you see. And it was a very sturdy plane. But
strictly for flight instruction?
Yes, for training, that's right. And you got so many hours dual, and then you were sent off solo on this, because you had to learn how to operate the rotary engine, you see. And,
what were the major problems with the rotary engine?
Well, it's not like the V8 or a stationary or the other type of engine. The engine is either on or off. You can adjust the mixture. You can adjust the mixture. But when you get in the plane to go for a flight, there's two mechanics there to start the motor, and they catch the blade, and they shout when they're ready, they shout contact,
mm-hmm.
and you put your switch on, and then petrol on, and they give it a swing, and if it catches, you give it a buzz. When it buzzes up, you pull it off, and as it begins to slow down, you buzz it again. It's on and off.
On and off.
On and off. On and off. Of course, when you take off, it's full on and it stays on. That's it.
Full on all the way up.
Yeah.
Well, now how did they receive you? You had all these great looking credentials on paper of all this wonderful flying, and here you are.
Well, I should say when you went to London, they decided whether you were going to do bombing, or artillery reconnaissance, or and wireless,
mm-hmm.
or whether you're going to be fighter pilot.
What was the criteria for that?
Well, they'd look back. I don't know how they arrived at that. Look back. I think there was a recommendation from Camp Hicks.
From your records?
Yeah,
previous
record fighter pilot.
Wasn't done alphabetically or anything.
No. And generally speaking, I think the heavier fellows were put on bombers. bombing. Because there were bigger machines
planes,
than the lighter fellows than the lighter planes, I don't know. But no rhyme or reason to it just happened.
Not at all.
But number four TDS, Training Depot Station, was all fighter pilots.
So you guys were selected as a fighter pilot?
Yes. So in London, after we were all segregated, according to that, and then once we were separated on different places, there was a dozen different stations in England where they went. And but we still had the Army, the U.S. Army boys, Signal Corps, with us, and
really?
some Navy boys. They kept us together. And because I've got pictures taken,
yes.
Two pictures taken there, which shows them. And but
under
they were not we were not only training pilots there at these stations. They were also training mechanics. and as many mechanics as there were pilots are all being trained, you see,
sure,
for the U.S. Air Force and so on. There was a distinctly a
this
training
is all under
center.
Royal Flying Corps.
All under Royal Flying Corps, yeah. And so we went from one machine to the other. Give us the as we well no first we give us some dual training, and then we're sent off solo, same setup as with the Curtiss. And then about that time, this was January, I came down with bronchopneumonia.
Oh gosh.
And they put me in hospital.
Oh, no.
You know, I lost nearly 4 weeks there. They were going to send me back home. They thought I'd had it, you see, and I wouldn't be able to take up flying. Might not be able to stand altitude and
mm-hmm.
so on, this sort of, with bronchopneumonia. But after about 3 or 4 weeks, I began to pick up. And within a month, I was back flying again.
You were back in the
yeah,
air.
I was back in the air, yeah.
That same place?
Same place, oh yes. This little hospital was, it wasn't on the aerodrome, it was a little town nearby. And
there's the telephone. Take a break here. You're in the hospital. You've recovered. They got you back in the air. You got a month to catch up on now, or what?
Well, yes, but meantime, the boys that I started out with, they were a month ahead of me, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And but that was all right. There was no big sweat at that time, and I was getting in an awful lot of time on arrows. Hang that off a minute until I get my logbook.
Certainly. So you had a lot of time to catch up on.
Yes, and
they give you extra flying time?
I had a lot of flying time there. I just think of all those arrows I flew.
Are you talking about 18 different arrows?
18 different arrows. So that meant that I was there on arrows for quite a long time. It was pretty good, because there wasn't a great demand early in the year from the front for pilots, so they weren't pushing us, you see. They were letting
us have a place for you to go anyway, is that
yeah,
right?
All that gave us all the training that was available we could have. So we had
well, what did training consist of? Just getting up in the air and getting hours under your belt, or?
Yes. Now then, on the aerodrome, I had a different, the second instructor was a chap by the name of Forson, a Scotch boy from the front, and he was a humdinger of a flyer. I think he tried his best to scare the liver out of me. He'd take me up, you see, and they'd travel along and head right into a bunch of trees, like that big tree there, you see, and then suddenly just go like that over it and down, and he'd go all around the place, just up and down like this. And, it didn't worry me. He was in control, and I knew I could see he was a good flyer, so I just took it all, and that was it. But he was teaching me what they call ground strafing, you see, traveling right on, almost on the ground. And then they had, instead of guns, they had cameras in the plane, you see, and you'd be diving on a target and you'd take pictures, you see, and they could tell from these pictures how close you were to the target and if you were firing a gun,
right.
You see. There was a little pond to the right of the aerodrome, and they had a little airplane about, oh, a little larger than this rug on that, and we'd go up and dive on that, you see, and take pictures. And that was what they call fighting practice. And here's a little incident on the side, this chap Forson. He really handled that plane roughly, and it could take it though. But this particular day, he was teaching me diving. I was in the back seat, he was the front seat. And he came over this, and then suddenly, he'd just do that.
Wait,
just flip
mouth.
Right over, you see,
with
and
flipper?
Nose straight down. And you're straight down on this target, you see, and come out. And he did that once, this particular incident. So sharply, he did this over that it shook the fire extinguisher. There's always a fire extinguisher in the side of the fuselage, and it was about that long. He shook this fire extinguisher loose. He went over so sharply, you see. And my recollection is sitting there, not a word in the world, because he was doing the flying. I didn't have to do it. And this fire extinguisher went up past us like that.
Because you were upside down.
Hmm?
You were upside down. The thing
no,
was
no, we were diving straight down. But we were going down so much faster than the fire extinguisher was, the fire extinguisher went up like that, and I could have put my hand out and picked
You're
it out of the air.
Kidding.
I did. Yes, we were diving with the engine on, you see. And
was there a lot of training accidents at all? Are there? Or
yes, there were a lot of not so many training accidents. Not if there was a, not if there was an instructor in the machine.
But just young fellows getting hours under their belt, or?
Well, you had to go through all this process of training, you see. And here's something I've said something about my guardian angel. Here's the one place where I had a guardian angel, because we were going down with the engine on, you see, and I don't remember ever touching that joystick, but my hand came out and I pulled the machine out, but I say I didn't do it. My guardian angel did it, and I landed the machine, and a head come up from the front seat when we down. He was as white as a sheet. I said, "What's the matter?" He said, when I went over, ripped over, my belt broke, and I landed on the controls down in the cockpit.
Oh, no.
And I couldn't get up. He said, "Thanks for landing the machine."
And you don't recall landing it at all?
No.
Why?
So there you are, you see. But his belt had broken, and the fire extinguisher had broken loose. As I say, I said, sitting there, I can still see that fire extinguisher going up past us like that.
You were going so
fast. Without a worry in the world. We were going down the gravity. We were going faster than gravity was taking that fire extinguisher down.
Gosh.
Well, that was one day. I still remember that night at the supper table. The officers, the higher officers that, and the trainers and so on, they had one table, and all us cadets were at a couple of other tables. But I could see this fellow talking to the other, the skipper, so on, telling about this incident, you see, and pointing me. And that's one thing. And another thing that might be of interest, still on Avros, I was sent up one day on an aerodrome. They had a circle. I forget what was in the circle, but there's a big white circle. And one of the things you had to do was go up with your Avro to 8,000 feet, shut off the engine, come down and land, and stop on that circle. Forced landing practice, you see. And this day, I went up, and it was a very foggy day. When you see where we were, we're right there on the Mersey.
Right on the river, yeah.
The river and the canal and the harbor and so on. One of the foggiest places in the world, rather than foggy. But however, I'd look over and I could see a little hole like that down the grass on the aerodromes and went on up and so on. Up at 7,000 feet. This was an old. These machines were just worked to death, you see, and only half the instruments were working on. But I had trouble getting it to 8,000 feet, 7,000 feet, and I was struggling to get it up to 8,000 feet because I got it as high as I could. When I looked down, I couldn't see anything below. It was just fog. No horizon, no nothing, you see. So I said, "Well, what'll I do?" Well, I figured I'd go into a spiral. Try to go into a spiral and come down that way, you see. But without any horizon, you'd find the wind blasting you on this side of it, just straighten up and get level again, and maybe go into a spiral the other way until you'd hear the wire singing a different tune, and you knew your nose was up too high. You'd get it down, or you'd get this blast on this side, and it'd straighten out and start over again. So well, I got down 7, 6, 5, 4, 3,000, 2,000, 1,000 feet. Still, I couldn't find that hole through the fog. It had thickened right up. And it was pea soup. So I said, "Well, this isn't too good. I'm only 1,000 feet up. What'll I do?" So I had a lot of experience with forced landings. You know, as I say, the engines were worked to death, the motors were worked to death, things were worked to death. And I've got out and had 5 and 6 forced landings in a day. I got really expert at forced landings. And those, you know, that part of the country is a little hedge, small fields with hedges all around.
Right.
There'd be sheep in this field, and there'd be cattle in that field, and so on. But I got so expert at four standings that nothing weighed me at all about the size of the field. I'd figure that I couldn't see any sheep or cattle in that field. I'd figure in that field as I come down, and my engine conked out, you see. And so what I did, I'd hit my wheels, bounce my wheels on this side of the hedge and bounce over the hedge and land on the other side, you see.
But do you even see the ground through the fog or what?
Well, this, I'm not speaking about fog.
Oh,
now.
I see. This is regular forced landing.
This is regular forced landings, you see, out in the countryside in Cheshire. And it happened. It happened every day. We got really, really expert at forced landing, and it was really a lifesaver later on.
Oh,
and that's the problem. That's the problem with these, all these fellows that are killed every day, you see in the paper. They've never been taught forced landings. And, for instance, somebody landed on the golf course and killed himself the other day.
Small plane, private plane.
Yeah, private plane. Well, that shouldn't be. Anybody could. If you're top horse landing, you get down anywhere. You get down on a dollar bill almost if you have plenty of experience. But this is something they had to do because of these small fields in England, you see. It was to fall plane down, and before I came to the hedge, I just bounced my wheels in the hedge, and then the plane would bounce over the hedge and land on the other side. Perfect. Then you go back to a house, get on the telephone, tell them where I was. Kind of come along, and maybe start the engine up again, and we'd swing it around to the corner of the field, and I'd take off again. Maybe get up here about 5 minutes, and the engine would come down again, you see. Not a forced landing. I've had five or six of those in one afternoon, you see. So you get to be an expert. But anyway, to go back to this foggy day, I got so without any engine that I could knew the volplaning speed and so on, just naturally, you see. And I said, well, I'll feel for the ground and see if I can find out where I am. So I came down and kept an eye close at the side. Water. Give her the gun. Up again. And fly for a minute or two. Feel for the ground again.
Well, did your altimeter work at all at this point, or?
Well, oh yes, your altimeter worked, but then you were only 400 or 500 feet up, you see.
Didn't matter.
And water again. Then it struck me like that. We had lost 2 pilots out over the Irish Sea a month or so previously. Nothing ever heard of in fog. They'd evidently got up there in fog and just lost themselves completely and came down the Irish Sea. There was no trace. I said, well, now I don't want to get out over the Irish Sea. What'll I do? And I said, I'll try and fly in a huge arc of a circle and maybe I'll hit land eventually. I figured that I might be able to go to the Irish Sea. So, but on the third time, have you ever been in Liverpool?
No.
On the waterfront, there's one huge long building with 2 towers on it. The towers are about, the building's about 6 or 7 stories high, and the towers are another 4 or 5 stories. And on top of each tower is a huge stork, or what they call a liver bird. That's where Liverpool got its name, you see, from the liver birds in the estuary of the Mersey, Liverpool. Well, there's a huge liver bird on the top of each one of these, and it's just a stork. That's what it is, a huge stork. Well, the third time when I came down to feel for the ground, watch a loom up in front of me, but this liver bird, boy, pulled the stick back so, and that accelerator on, the gas on as fast as I could, and just scraped over it. And, I was tickled pink, you know.
Well,
I should have been scared to death, but I wasn't. I was tickled pink. I found land,
yeah.
And I knew where I was, and I saw that liver bird. This was fine. And I just should have been scared to death, but I wasn't the slightest. I was happy as a lark. But I started firing on. But in Liverpool, there are a lot of overhead telegraph wires all over the place. I nearly got mixed up, and I said, this isn't a healthy place to be. I could look down, and I could see the people on the sidewalk about this tall.
So you got a break in the fog now?
Yes. You get on land, it is a little bit thinner, but I can see the people down below about that tall looking up at me, you see. So I said, I've got to get out of here somewhere or other. What'll I do again? I'll pick one street, doesn't matter what street, but I'll pick one street and I'll follow it to the end. It'll eventually take me into the country. So that's what I decided, but I picked the worst street I could have. Through what they call Bootle. And that's where all the foundry workers live, that little one story attached, the whole block of it attached
right.
out of one solid tenement, except that on the street corner, instead of being one story, it's usually two or three stories in the corner, and then all one story for another block, and so on. So I went through mile after mile of these houses, and the fog was got thicker all the time because that was a bad district, a foundry district, you see. But eventually, I kept on going and dodging over these ends. Finally, then I separated what they call detached houses to duplexes, you see. And I said, well, we're getting out. You know, there's a duplex. And finally, we got single houses. And then I could see railroad tracks. There was a big Y railroad track. And there was a big building over there of some kind, at least something. I didn't know what it was. But there was a field with a haystack at the far end and a low shed at this end. And that field's plenty big enough. I can get into that easily. And even if I didn't make a good landing, there was a haystack at the other end.
Yeah.
So I shut off, came down, landed in that field. And I'm down. But I looked up and looked around, and here was a red cap with two soldiers with fixed bayonets coming at me. I said, for God's sake, what am I into now? And this red cap came up to me, and he swore at me a yard long. So I let him go ahead. They got all off his system and didn't say a word. And then when he was through, I said, okay, now, what's the trouble? Where am I? I said, I'm lost in the fog. I landed the first field big enough to get into. Where am I? And he said, you see that shed that you landed over just off the corner of it? I said, yeah, I didn't hit it. No, he said, I'm glad you didn't, because if you did, you'd still be going up, and all the rest of us would be going up, because in that shed is all the high explosive to blow up one of the ridges in France. And he said, this is a restricted area. You know, don't you know that? I said, no. I don't know anything in the fog. I just find a place to get down and get down safely. So I said, well, I bet I didn't touch it. We're all here safe and sound. But I wonder if you'd get on the phone to Hooton Park and talk to my OC and tell him where I am and see what he has to say. So we went up to the office and telephoned him, and he said, he said, you're down, where are you? I said, in a restricted area where I'm not supposed to be. He said, well, thank goodness you're all right. And down, he said, there are six instructors lost in this fog and so many other pilots.
Oh.
And he said, things are in a bad way, but I'm glad you're there. Now then, I said, well, what'll I do? He said, well, the only thing you can do, he said, wait till the fog lifts and fly around until we get back home if you can when the fog lifts. That's all you can do. Okay, that's fine. So we went back and had some more fun with these people, and the fog began to lift outskirts. We were away from the city, you see, out in the fields, and away from the water, quite a piece away from the water. So how to get off? How to get off, you see, it takes about three to get one of those rotary planes, planes with rotary motors off the ground. So there were these two privates, and this red cap, I've forgotten what his rank was now. But I said, now then, in order to get off here, this is what we have to do. You'll have to get in the cockpit, and I'll show you how to operate the controls,
mm-hmm.
and tell you the whole story. And I'll take the propeller, and the two pilots will connect up to me. And when I'm swinging around, and get some compression, they'll look at us, I'll shout to you, contact, and you throw this switch on. Then I'll shout petrol on, and you push the petrol on. At that moment, we'll swing the propeller. These fellows will swing me away from the propeller. If it catches, okay, you do this. Switch it on, let it rev up, and then when it gets revved up, shut it off. And it starts to slow down, rev it up again until I get around the cockpit and get my hand on the throttle. So, he was a good student. And we got it in the first go.
Oh, that's good.
And so I got my hand on the throttle and got him out of the cockpit, and I got in, and then I had them swung back later on so that I'd face the long angle towards this structure, whatever it was over there, and I found out what it was. Then I said, "What is that, Billy?" He said, "That's the Aintree racetrack. You know, that's the second big racetrack in England."
Oh my God.
Aintree. So I took off right over the stands of the Aintree racetrack, and I figured, now I can fly around Liverpool. If I can find the tanks at Gastown, there are a lot of tanks for Liverpool where all the gas is stored, burning gas, you see. And if I can find that, I can fly blind from there into the aerodrome and land blind.
Right.
I don't care if I can't see anything. I can shut my eyes and land. I count to myself just how many to get over the river, over the canal, onto the aerodrome. Time to turn, feel the ground, and land. Fog. That's what I did. I found Gastown and just flew blind over the crowd, and then when I figured it was time to get in, just practice make perfect, you see, and landed, and the runway's up to the hangars, you see, and a couple of sergeants came out, "Where did you come from? How did you get in out of this PC? Where you been?" And then he told me how many instructors were lost and so on. I told them where I was away in the restricted district on the northwest of Liverpool, and then I came in and landed blind, and here I am. And he said, "Well, good for you. You better go and see the OC." Well, that is it. I showed them that I got down, and I told them the whole story and how it happened, you see, and why it happened. And but gradually, during the day, the fog lifted and the other fellows were located. They were all over the countryside. I don't think anybody was hurt. I don't remember if there were any machine crashed. I think everybody got down pretty well. But that's another incident in training.
Well, how long were you here at Hooton Park now?
At Hooton Park.
How long were you there, and what dates are we talking about here?
All right. Oh, I was wrong. Oh, yes. No, that's right. Benbrook is Texas. Camp Borden. The last flight at Camp Borden was November the 12th. 1917, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Last one out of Texas.
And then Texas. Benbrook. Hicks. January the 2nd.
18.
From January the 2nd, 1918, to February the 14th, 1918, in transit from School of Aerial Gunnery, Camp Hicks, Texas, USA, to number 4 TDS, Hooton Park, Cheshire, England.
This takes you to February. Then you were sick.
February the 14th.
Then you were sick in...
That's been in February then. Let's see, how about dates here? February 1918. 22nd, I flew on the 22nd, the 24th, and the 25th of February. March, 25th of February, well, the 25th of March, not quite, the 20th of March, a few days short of a month. So in that period is where I was down with the pneumonia.
While at Hooton Park.
25th of February to 20th of March. Bronco pneumonia.
Yeah. When was your last flight at Hooton Park? What date is that, if you have your book there?
Yeah. Mind you, listen, I had flown Airbus, I'd flown Pups, and I'd flown Dolphins.
Well, you'd be a fairly accomplished pilot after
Oh, yes. I've done a lot of flying. I can give you the hours here.
If you wouldn't mind.
Hooton. Hooton. Oh boy, I did a lot of flying at Hooton. Yeah. Total solo for a week ending 22nd of June, 1918. 14 hours and 50 minutes, inspector, 15 hours. Total solo to date, 90 hours and 45 minutes. Total solo on Dolphin, 14 hours and 50 minutes.
So you had about 100 hours, approximately 100 hours flying time under your belt. Mm-hmm. Now you're off to France. Is that correct?
Yep. Here's the. No, we're off to Turnberry. Finishing school.
You went to finishing school. What's taught there?
Aerial fighting mostly. Aerobatics, they call it.
So you knew how to get down when you're in trouble.
Total time solo on Curtis, 27 hours and 50 minutes. Total time duo on Avro, 9 hours and 40 minutes. Total time solo on Avro, 24 hours and 25 minutes. Total time on Pup, 23 hours and 10 minutes. That was Barb, that was heaven. And Dolphin, 14 hours and 50 minutes. Now there's 59.
What date would this be?
Well,
maybe your approximation there in your log.
22nd of June.
22nd June, yeah. 1918.
Yeah.
You went to finishing school and taught aerobatics. Now you knew how to get yourself out of trouble, I guess, through the elementary schools, and how to land and get your basic skills.
Oh yeah,
skills.
So flying, total flying. Well, that's the only thing you had at finishing school was stunting, turns, climbing, vertical turns, half rolls, loops, aerobatics. That covers it all. Aerobatics, you see. Aerobatics, fighting practice, aerobatics, fighting, formation flying, gunnery, stoppages on your Vickers guns, how to correct stoppages,
right.
Gunnery, they give you a lot of gunnery, roller, they had rafts and roller targets, you see, they take up in the air and dive on them and fire, you see, and gunnery, formation and fighting. Stoppages. An awful lot on the machine guns. Here we are. When I left Hooton Park, 4TDS, for Turnberry near Ayr in Scotland, I picked up flu in Liverpool. I landed in Turnberry with flu, the first case of flu in Turnberry. The reason we were sent to Turnberry, which they were washing out, was because 4TDS didn't have any flu. Otherwise, if it had flu in Turnberry, we'd go to Marsk on the east coast. So, I suppose we set up there. This is another one, but somewhere in here, I arrived at Turnberry, let's see. I arrived at Turnberry. Yes, well, I didn't get to flying in Turnberry until the 17th of July. So from the 18th of June to the 17th of July, I was out with influenza pneumonia.
Oh, gosh.
And that was when I arrived at Turnberry, I knew I was in for it. I knew it was flu. So I went to the desk and I got some 217s or Astras, and I said, give me a bottle of either brandy or rum. I got a bottle of brandy rum, went to bed, took two or three of these tablets and the whole bottle of rum. I knew that I had to get a good big sweat on. That's my only salvation, you see. The last thing I remember was lying on my side and feeling the perspiration rolling in streams down my back. And I don't know, evidently I went off, whether I went to sleep or whether I went unconscious, I don't know. But I was out for between 2 and 3 days because the orderly said he put his nose around the door every morning to see if I was still alive, and if he could see any movement of chest, why, he'd go out. Didn't expect me to last, you see. But the third morning he came in, and I was awake. He said, "What, are you alive?" I said, "I think so." But you know, I had perspired through one mattress that thick and a half of another mattress that thick, a mattress and a half. I must have lost about 30 pounds, I guess, in those 3 days, just sweated out.
Just dehydrated.
Yeah. So Yes, they had a full hospital there.
Well, why weren't you in the small hospital?
Well, they didn't want flu anywhere else. There was flu in that room.
Persona non grata,
is that? They kept me isolated there, yes. And they only went that one look each morning, you see. But when I was alive and it was over with, they put me in a stretcher and they took me down to the hospital. Put me in the hospital. Gradually, I found my feet again. But I have a picture taken during that with a walking stick and I'm thin as a rake. But eventually, I say after a month, 28 or 29 days, I was out flying again. Tremendous comeback.
Comeback.
And